Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Michael Brook. He is the Strickland Curator of Ornithology at the University Museum of Zoology, Cambridge. And we're talking about his latest book, Far From Land, The Mysterious Lives of Seabirds. Mike, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, I enjoyed writing it, and I hope that's evident in the book itself.
First, I want to talk about seabirds. I have to say, as a person who watches birds, there's a romance to seabirds. I can remember the first time I saw a greater shearwater. I had never seen a bird like that before move through the water, through wave troughs, I should say, effortlessly. There's something special about seabirds. Did you fall in love with seabirds, too?
I certainly did, and I mean, the thing that I think especially appeals to me is that not only are they the creatures wonderful and they enable you to ask interesting questions as a scientist, but they do give you a legitimate excuse to go to some of the most wonderful places in the world. I mean, you can think Tristan da Cunha, where most of the world's great shearwaters nest before they head during the northern summer to your part of the world.
I was on Lord Howe Island watching black-winged petrels do their display over their nesting holes. And I was in Tierra del Fuego watching shearwaters parade by. And you're right. I mean, you get to, when you see them, it's always a special event. Let's talk about what species you include in this book as seabirds. You include a lot of different kinds of birds as seabirds.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, Mark, that it's a fairly arbitrary distinction between seabirds and non-seabirds. So, you know, traditionally we're talking about gulls and terns, although, of course, some of those species live inland. We're talking the auks, so puffins, murres, and so forth, the petrels, shearwaters, albatrosses, the penguins. So those are the ones that are normally encompassed with seabirds. Oh, and I should also mention cormorants, frigate birds, and allies. And then other species, like some of the ducks, which to all intents and purposes are seabirds, are just almost by tradition not included as seabirds, but I fully accept that it's a little bit arbitrary.
And there's some interesting species that probably most people have never heard of. Prions and diving petrels are two groups of birds. I've had a chance to see both of those, and those are very unique birds, very unique, and definitely seabirds.
They're unquestionably seabirds. Both groups are confined to the southern hemisphere. I mean, prions are very much species of the Southern Ocean, and they have rather large bills for their size. I mean, they weigh about 100, 140 grams, so maybe the size of an American robin or a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And those rather large flattened bills are used for sieving out plankton. The diving petrels, four species, are, as their name implies, a species that dives underwater to catch mostly plankton, and the etiological equivalent of them in the northern hemisphere is the little auk in English, the dovekie in North America.
Oh, yeah. Now, for people who are listening who may not be birders, if you've ever gone out on a whale watch here off the coast of New England, and while you're out there have seen these amazing long-winged birds careening through the wave troughs, and then little dark ones, which look almost like swallows on the waves. Those are most likely Wilson storm petrels. And we have four species of shearwaters that we regularly see here off our coast. You've seen these seabirds and certainly have seen cormorants. But this book is much more than just about the birds, because this is a book that's about modern electronics and how it's revolutionizing our knowledge of these birds. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, up until about 20, maybe 30 years ago, our knowledge of seabirds was really garnered either by encounters at sea and also by deduction from colony or shore-based observations. So, for example, you know, if a bird brought back squid from the sea to feed its chit. You knew it had been feeding on squid, but frankly, you had very little idea where it caught those squid. But starting around 1990, modern electronic devices have been available to put on birds, and I think it's fair to say it's totally revolutionized our knowledge of what the birds do at sea. So we can now put several types of devices that record position, and that those devices can be deployed for a year or even 2 years at a time, and then you catch the bird, download the data, and you've got a two-year picture of where the bird has been. In addition to the positional information, there are other devices that record whether the leads are wet or dry, so that tells you pretty much whether the bird at sea is flying or sitting on the water. And then if it's on the water, other devices will tell you how deep it's dived. And then there are modern accelerometers that give you a very detailed track of its movements underwater. And these, for example, can tell you when the bird makes abrupt movements that probably indicate the moment it actually catches some prey underwater. And, of course, you know the depth that that has happened. And then there are other devices that record how wide the beak is open. And obviously, to swallow a big bit of food, you have to open your mouth wider than to swallow a small bit of food. And then the other one that springs to mind is temperature sensors in the stomach. And what they can do is record a drop in temperature, and that would indicate that the bird has swallowed a bit of food that is at a lower temperature than itself. And obviously, the bigger the item of low-temperature food, the greater will be the temperature drop in the stomach. So it's an exaggeration to say that we can monitor the seabirds as closely as somebody in intensive care. But the amount of detail that is available is really astonishing, given that this is all happening over the horizon, 1,000 kilometers from shore.
It is incredible. And just to give people an idea of why seabirds are so challenging to study, let's talk about the greater shearwater. When I see greater shearwaters, they're off the coast here in Massachusetts, stay from midsummer into early fall. And they're on an enormous journey, which is only going to be over the ocean and only sometimes visible to humans. Where do they nest?
So the biggest colonies are in the Tristan da Cunha group. So roughly speaking, that's halfway between Cape Town at the southern tip of Africa and South America, so pretty close to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. I think the biggest colony is that on Nightingale Island, which is 20 miles or so from inhabited Tristan da Cunha, and there's around 3 million pairs there. The Tristan Islanders harvest them in moderate numbers, so the colonies can certainly withstand that offtake. And I've actually spent some time on Nightingale with a Tristan person, and he produced really delicious chips, well, French fries in North American, fried in shearwater oil. And I'm not sure whether I should recommend that to your listeners. But anyway, and I mean, the numbers gathering offshore at dusk are just astonishing. And in fact, some of the rocks on the island are marked with claw marks that have been scarred by thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of shearwaters scrambling up rocks to reach a takeoff point so that they can launch off Nightingale.
These islands that the greater shearwaters live on are, unless to the poor people, I mean the people who live there, it's a small population, but they're incredibly difficult to get to. And this is the point about why all these modern electronics are so important. These birds are almost inaccessible most of the time. And when we even see them from the shore, they're just sort of basically zipping by at a tremendous speed. And it's very great to see them, but we don't really get to learn that much about their life if it hasn't been for this electronic revolution.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite right. And I mean, not only are they zipping by, but you're slightly uncertain as to whether the ones you're seeing are actually representative of the whole population.
That's right.
Or whether, in fact, most of the action is happening out of sight, out of mind, over the horizon.
And also a number of these species, and I'm thinking of like leeches, storm petrels here in North New England, they enter the burrows, pre-dawn and leave at dusk, and we don't even see them most of the time. Even though leeches, storm petrels breed here commonly, we have to go in a pretty far distant pelagic in order to even see them. So a lot of them are even inaccessible, even if they nest here.
Yeah, that's quite right. And I mean, one of the things that's emerged very clearly, and I mean, people had had some suspicion of this before, is how different species like to feed in different zones. So some may feed over the continental shelf,
right.
So in relatively shallow water, and then some seem to specialize on the shelf break, so that's where the continental shelf abruptly turns down to plunge into the deep ocean, and then some species seem to like to forage principally over really, really deep water, so we're talking water of, say, 4 kilometers depth or thereabouts.
It's amazing, and you write about this in the book. There are large stretches of ocean where there's hardly any birds. They're over very specific areas. For instance, the tropics don't have a lot of seabirds on them.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. In fact, the regions of the ocean that are least productive of all are not, strictly speaking, along the equator, but maybe at 20 degrees of latitude either side. So these are the zones of very blue sea, and it's very blue sea because there's very little plankton in
right.
it. And those are really unproductive, and you know, I've been on a yacht, bored stiff, waiting for the one bird a day to go by.
That sounds like the worst pelagic trip in my
Well, life. I mean, just sort of to put you right, not so much a pelagic trip as the need to get from A to B, and a yacht was the only means of doing that.
But boy, if there was no birds on the water at all, I would go crazy. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. My guest, this is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Michael Brook. He is the Strickland Curator of Ornithology at the University Museum of Zoology, Cambridge. And we're talking about his latest book. It's fascinating. Far From Land, The Mysterious Lives of Seabirds. Now, this book really brings out the information that we have found about these different species thanks to this new technology. And it really ends up almost like every species has a unique story. There's a whole chapter about birds taking their first flights and how dangerous that is. And the example you give is the black-footed albatross in the Hawaiian Islands. And this is a big bird. Describe what a black-footed albatross is like.
I'm not sure whether many of your readers will have seen albatrosses, but the smaller ones, like black-footed, would be a little bit bigger than a gannet, which can be seen off the England coast.
By the hundreds.
And the black-footed albatross is essentially all chocolate brown, and it's a North Pacific species. High proportion of the world population nests on the atolls at the northwestern end of the Hawaiian chain, and this is something actually that has figured in some of the David Attenborough programs. When they're fledging, they're obviously not the most proficient of flyers.
Oh, no.
And there's a risk that they will crash land, when I say crash land, crash into the sea just offshore in the lagoon of the atoll. And there, tiger sharks have developed the habit of knowing when to pitch up and snatch young black-footed albatrosses.
Do they have any kind of strategy to sort of overcome this?
No, I don't think anything that you could honestly call a strategy. get the hell out of there as soon as possible.
I've seen some of these incredible cliffs in northern Scotland where there's alcids just by the thousands breeding. We call them Muirs here. You call them guillemots. There's puffins breeding in burrows. When they first take their first flight, what happens with the birds? I mean, these chicks have been on these narrow ledges for their entire, since hatching, and they have to take that first flight. What is the behavior? Does a parent lead them out and then call to them?
Okay, so there's a real difference there between razorbills and guillemots / murres,
yep,
and puffins. So let's talk for a moment about the guillemots first. They, as you say, are nesting on a cliff ledge, and when the chick is about a third of the body size of its parents, it's ready to leave, and the parent at that time will be just offshore calling, and that call provides a target for the youngster, which leaps off the cliff, flutters down, all being well reaches the water, and then goes off into the wide blue yonder with its parent. And what's kind of intriguing, and nobody really knows the answer to this, is that the parent guillemot or mer, or indeed razorbill that accompanies the chick, is always the male, the father. The female doesn't play a part at this stage. And why there's that difference between the sexes really isn't known. And there's one amazing study from a Greenland colony, so that's Brunet guillemot, Brunet mer, where they tracked father and chick together on the southbound journey, because obviously you've got to leave Greenland for the winter. And that tracking went over about 3,000 kilometers. So dad and son or daughter stayed together on the water for a 3,000 kilometer swim. Just astonishing. And we don't really know how they maintain contact, but presumably it's mostly by voice.
And they're swimming. They're not flying?
At that stage, they're swimming, yes, because the young, when it leaps off the cliff, can manage a downward glide, but it certainly can't maintain horizontal flight. So it takes a month or two until that becomes possible. So that journey is definitely a swimming journey.
What are the things that's, for anybody who reads about seabirds, their migrations, their travels are mind-boggling. They're like no other bird on the planet, virtually. A species like the gray-headed albatross is away from the colony for 18 months. That means it's 18 months, it's at sea. And now that we've been able to track them, some of the miles, the kilometers that they travel is just amazing. In the case of the gray-headed albatross, there's a record of them doing 950 kilometers per day. Did I read that right?
Oh yes, but I mean it is astounding. But you can also flip your way of thinking. So you say to yourself, these birds are going to be flying at least 40 kilometres an hour, and if we'll be generous and allow them 4 hours rest on the sea each day.
Okay.
So that leaves 20 hours of flying at 40 kilometres an hour, 800. Kilometers covered in the day, easy peasy.
It's still impressive. And when I look at something like the ancient murrelet, which is a kind of alcid, it's this little stubby bird that makes round trips of 8,000 kilometers. That's and you write about that in your book. That's incredible to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a remarkable journey from colonies in off the coast of British Columbia across the seas of Japan, and it's not terribly certain why the bird should choose to do that long journey rather than what at first sight would be the rather simpler journey down the west coast of
right.
the US to waters that are just as productive as Japanese waters off Oregon or California.
Some of the speeds that these birds make, especially the albatrosses, and the gadfly petrels are pretty amazing too. There's a record of a gray-headed albatross again doing 130 kilometers per hour speed when it's driven homeward by Southern Ocean storms. And that brings up the fact that these birds are flying no matter what the weather.
Yes, they're certainly flying pretty much whatever the weather. I mean, the nicest story I came across, which I actually quote from the book, concerns not strictly a seabird, but a shorebird, a whimbrel, and that was tracked flying into on its fall migration, so heading south along the eastern seaboard of the U.S. towards Brazil, crosses routinely the Caribbean. On its way, it encountered a hurricane, and whilst I can't exactly remember the speeds that were recorded, essentially flying into the hurricane, it was going at 10 or 15 miles an hour, passed through the eye, was spat out the other side at, say, 80 miles an hour. And then almost the most remarkable thing was that once it was clear of the storm, but still over the sea, it had a plan B in its locker and turned right to get it back to the seaboard of the U.S. So, you know, even in those severe conditions, and obviously I'm speaking anthropomorphically, in those severe conditions, the bird had its wits about it and had an escape plan that it was able to put into effect.
Well, the next question is, how are these birds navigating over the ocean, which seems virtually featureless?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we really know quite a lot about land bird navigation these days. So they certainly use the stars. They certainly use information from the sun. They certainly use magnetic information. And at least in some circumstances, they use smell.
That's what I want you to talk about, because when I read that in the book, that really surprised me. How would a seabird use smell to navigate?
Well, I think this is very much up for grabs at present. We don't know the story. So the first thing to say is, if you put, for example, a European robin in a cage where normally it would orient in the right direction during the migration season and obscure the sky, it will still probably get it right. And that seems to be using a magnetic sense. And how you can demonstrate that is putting a tiny magnet around the cage, which would disrupt the magnetic
right.
sense, and that disrupts the bird's ability to orient. In the case of seabirds, people have done similar experiments with free-flying birds rather than cage birds, and there's really very little sign that they're using magnetism. So the application of magnets doesn't disrupt their ability to navigate. So the possibility is that smell is more important, and we know for sure that seabirds do use smell. You've mentioned once or twice pelagic tricks.
You lay out a chum line, and they show up instantaneously.
And they show up. And experiments with birds whose sense of smell has been temporarily disrupted. I mean, basically, you can put a chemical up their noses and disrupt their sense of smell for a week or two, they show much reduced ability to get back home quickly.
Huh.
So that certainly implies that smell is important in navigation. But what I think isn't known at all yet is there some smellscape over the ocean that could be a useful navigational tool? Some researchers and some, you know, very good and respected researchers think that that is a possibility. But my view is it's yet to be nailed down.
It seems like you could also smell land at a distance, and that could help position them too.
Yes, but I mean, remember that species in the midst of the Southern Ocean are maybe 1,000 kilometers from land.
God.
I mean, literally. So how useful would the smell of land be at that sort of distance? I don't know.
When we see birds like shearwaters, and especially albatrosses, soaring on these fixed wings out over the ocean, it seems effortless. How are they able to maintain this sort of stiff-winged position of their body and make the most out of the winds?
Well, I mean, the case of albatrosses, there's a what's sort of referred to as a shoulder lock. So essentially, when they have got their wings fully stretched out, there's no extra work required to hold them in position. So combine that with the fact that they can essentially make use of the difference in wind speed at various levels above the sea to gain height, then glide down, gain height again, then glide down. And the cost in terms of work, effort of gliding is actually pretty trivial.
Wow. We're almost out of time, and I want to address threats to seabirds. And you address this in the book at the end, there's many threats. And obviously, because we're imperiling the ocean, there's that giant pile of garbage in the middle of the Pacific. But you mentioned fishing is potentially one of the greatest dangers to seabirds.
Fishing, for sure, poses considerable threats. And this can come about in various ways. So it can be because the stock of fish on which the birds feed is much reduced by fishing activities. And obviously, if there's less food for the birds, that's, broadly speaking, bad news. And then there's the threat from direct interaction with fishing vessels. So particularly prominent in recent years has been the threat posed to albatrosses by longlining. So we're talking lines of literally tens of kilometers in length streaming out behind a boat with many thousands of hooks on them. And the particular danger arises when the line is being set, and for a short period the baited hook is accessible to the birds behind the boat, and they can grab the hook, get hooked, dragged under the water, and then they're retrieved by the fisherman 6 hours later or whatever, and obviously dead by then.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We could talk about this book for years. My guest tonight has been Michael Brook. He's the Strickland Curator of Ornithology at the University Museum of Zoology, Cambridge. And we've been talking about a book. Again, if you ever go out on a whale watch this summer here and see these incredible greater sooty corys and Manx shearwaters off our shore, read this book, Far From Land, The Mysterious Lives of Seabirds. Mike, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.